Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And we left off yesterday with me kind of diving forward into the next clause, and I didn't necessarily account for the fact that the show actually ended as soon as I finished reading the clause, and it's another one of those clauses that is being violated. But anyway, Paul, welcome back, and I really appreciate your participation in this process.
And so where was it we left off? Is it okay, no tax or duty?
So, yeah, it's Article 1, Section 9, and no tax or duty be laid. But what I want to do, because in the past couple of days, actually since we kind of started, I've been reading more of these, and what I'd rather do and what I should be doing, because I don't want to just – because I feel like I'm rushing it, and that's not my intent. So what I'd rather do is have you read the clause and kind of reflect on it and then go, okay, so – and you're using the color-coded Constitution, right?
Correct.
Okay, so that way you're saying, you can see that this is a clause that's being violated. And you can go, okay, so this is highlighted. Plus, I need your help because there may be parts of the Constitution that is not highlighted – that is being violated. You go, hey, is this possibly being violated by this or that? And so anyway, because I'm thinking that the next section is being violated, but you know, that's because the whole process is to actually get more and more accurate to the Constitution and how or what and if it is being violated. You know, I can't impress enough. If you're going to learn, folks, the Constitution, you need to understand, you know, that it is the supreme law and how much of this supreme law is being disregarded, disrespected, and actually literally trampled upon by the federal government and the state governments. So with that, let's go ahead, read the clause and give it some reflection and your thoughts on it. Go ahead.
Well, Section 9 is particularly juicy, so here we are. No tax or duty shall be laid on articles exported from any state. Now, I think, GR, we mean that states are not going to lay tax or duties on the articles of each other, correct?
Now, that would be Section 10, restrictions placed upon the states. Section 9 is a restriction placed upon the federal government. In other words, the federal government, there will be no tax or duty that shall be laid on articles exported from any state by the federal government.
So when you say exported from any state, let's say exported out of the country.
Out of the country or from one state to another. That is correct.
So, in other words, the federal government is not going to – just a minute. The federal government is not going to lay a charge on the states for exporting goods.
Yeah, so the operative word here is duty. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So duty is not necessarily just a tax itself. It's not just, hey, you got to give us money for producing that and exporting that. It's creating a duty or a burden upon the manufacturer or the state. So when we look at how the states were and are producing materials and what have you, are there constraints on whether they can actually produce? When you actually start creating, and I'll give you a good example. When the federal government provides subsidies on food that, you know, let's say the Corn Belt, right? Mm-hmm. With, you know, when we talk about the Corn Belt of America, that's a very specific area that is just, you know, very good at producing corn. And right. So when the federal government comes along and basically says, hey, we're going to subsidize the farmers to not grow corn.
Would you call that? What would you call that?
So is that a burden placed upon the states by not letting them, by basically inducing and keeping the people? Because how much, so you got to understand that when a farmer produces food and they ship that out, there is a tax placed upon the farmer, right? Because when they sell that, that's revenue in to the farmer. Does the Correct. State tax revenue? Yes, absolutely. So the intent here was the federal government was not to tax revenue. But what happens when the federal government takes away revenue from the state? Is that a burden? Is that a duty?
It's interesting to look at it that way. If you're not producing, you know, I don't know, but it takes something more away because we expect the founder's idea, and I think in natural terms, we should be producing. And to subsidize non-production is just deleterious in many ways, GR.
Right.
You just, it's hard to wrap. When you think about it, it's hard to wrap your mind around it because the land's not productive, the people aren't productive, the machinery is not productive, or if you're a large farmer, you can move your production to something else or to another area.
Right.
But what happens is when it's hard to ramp up something to production when you haven't been doing it for a while. Right.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's
it is.
One thing.
You're in farming. Your equipment gets old.
Okay.
Right. And
yeah. Right. Okay. Unless you repurpose it to somewhere mm-hmm. else. Yeah. But here's the other thing. If I'm imagining, you know, most large farmers, and I'm saying family farms, aren't necessarily like this because I know a lot of family farmers, but let's say you've got someone who's just living off, okay, the subsidy and not producing.
Mm-hmm.
One piece, you know, here's what happens. You get comfortable. And when you get comfortable, it is harder to do the hard thing. You know what I mean? And start up again. It's harder to start up if you're not doing. It's not just harder to restart your equipment or get right. the land going.
Yes. So what you're saying, let me just try to interpret. The longer somebody takes the subsidies, the harder it is to get away from it.
Absolutely.
Okay.
That's right. Thanks for clarifying that.
Okay.
That's
exactly right. So, but actually what I did was I gave you a theoretical. Because it says no tax or duty shall be laid on articles exported from any state. Well, you know, it does create a duty upon the articles if you don't let them come out of the state because you've basically said you're not producing. But actually, when you really look at this and this specific clause and violations of it, at this point in time, the federal government had no ability to tax corporations, correct?
Right.
How were taxes laid? At this point in time, taxes were being laid upon the states and they were apportioned based on the population of the state, not by corporations, corporation funds, and so forth. And the fact is that when the states, or I should say, when the federal government actually started creating direct taxes on corporations, they now actually were taxing on with goods, whether they were produced and exported or not exported, services provided.
Something they're, which you're saying something they're not supposed to do.
Right, because, see, it was that's a double tax.
So imagine this, Jer. But see, here's...
That would have... So, that, so but my point is that would have been a double tax. And going into... And basically, what the 16th Amendment did was this was another part of the, how the 16th Amendment basically ignored this one part. That it was one thing to create an income tax on the people, but right. to reach into corporations, now you're actually taxing the goods. Because what does a corporation do if all of a sudden they have to pay $10, you know, a bushel or whatever, you know, they're going into agriculture, but let's just say widgets. You know, they have to pay a percent, a 20% on the widgets that they sell. They add that to the price.
Right. They pass that on to consumer. In actuality, corporations don't pay taxes. They just pass that cost right along. And I think that's what you're meaning by a double tax, right?
Absolutely. So, yes. And so are the there's this cost of doing business. Right. Right. I mean, labor is the cost of doing business. So when you're paying people to do something, to sell something, whatever you're doing, then that right there is an income tax, which is, a you know, the direct taxes when you're taxing them is an income tax. And going into the corporation and actually taxing the profits of the corporation, which then all of a sudden creates a direct duty or tax upon the services or products being produced. And so this really created more of a double tax, and it's an insatiable tax that becomes this, I'll just say, it's a self-licking ice cream cone, especially when you look at how the circulation of money and the inflation of currency can actually increase taxation as well.
So what you're saying is this is something that the 16th Amendment did not take into account. It's kind of like the conflict that that the 17th Amendment has with the 5th Amendment. It was
yes.
wasn't completely thought out or done properly.
Correct.
And because of that, we have we've got a conflict that probably ought to be addressed.
Well, so what happened was the states didn't realize that the 16th Amendment violated the Uniformity Clause. It violated this. I mean, correct. The 16th Amendment kind of had a lot of extra reaches, but what it didn't do was it did not authorize the federal government to just spend money crazily, to be able to take money and put it on anything it had no authority to do. See, most people mm-hmm. confuse the 16th Amendment as a license to spend money.
Right.
It didn't do that. And so anybody that says, oh, well, the 16th Amendment is the problem. No, technically, it's the spending of money that caused the 16th Amendment. Oh, well, we need to tax more because we're spending more on things we shouldn't be spending. The one person that wasn't there to state the obvious when this idea was floated to say is, hey, stop spending money on things you have no authority to do so that we don't have to be taxed more.
But they wanted to spend money on things they had no authority to do.
And right? they sold that. And America, whether we look at it as America allowed it to happen or what, it still was a violation, right? I mean, right, wrong, or indifferent, it was a violation. Even if America said, okay, we're going to let you tax us more, that did not give them license to do things unconstitutionally. The only way to do that would be through an amendment.
Correct.
So most people think that the amendment on its face, you know, kind of gave a rubber stamp, but it really didn't. The only way government can actually spend money on healthcare is to amend the Constitution to give them the authority with healthcare and to spend money on it and to actually delegate that authority. The only thing the 16th Amendment did was it delegated the authority to tax income instead of using apportionment. In other words, they stopped doing that. But in doing this, they actually started violating these other little parts because all of these things were connected.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Because the states were to be protected from this insatiable, you know, taxation machine. I mean, we read through the ratification debates. A lot of it was talking about taxes.
Right.
And how, you know, they didn't want this, you know, this huge burden of the government just taking all their wealth. I mean, it was constantly being brought up that how can we pay, you know, the state tax and federal tax? It's going to crush us. It'll destroy us. Actually, the way the Constitution was designed, it didn't. But when they made the 16th Amendment change, that actually became a crushing blow. I mean, because it has contributed to inflation and, you know, other financial problems because, you know, they're spending money and taking loans out because they're spending more money than they're bringing in. So in other words, they're creating debt, and then they're creating this cost of the interest of debt. Remember the old saying, you know, a fool pays interest, a wise man earns it. Well, America's taking the path of the fool because we just spend more and more money on interest to where today we're barely able to pay the interest with the money we have coming in.
Correct.
Okay. And all of this, by the way, is all fraud. Or I should say, just because they have the ability to tax us in the ways that they tax us does not authorize them to spend the money on all of the things that they're spending money on. The vaccinations, creating vaccinations for the world, giving out welfare for the world, giving out welfare for, you know, disasters. Anyway, go ahead.
I think maybe the next clause will address that a little bit. Okay. Because
go ahead.
If you don't, no money shall be drawn from the treasury, but in consequence of
you missed the clause that's not highlighted.
No, I'm sorry, I did.
Yeah, go ahead.
No preference shall be given by any regulation of commerce or revenue to the ports of one state over those of another, nor shall vessels bound to or from one state be obliged to enter, clear, or pay duties to another. That one's not highlighted. I was actually looking at the next highlighted one. If you don't have anything to share on the one I just read, I'd like to go to the next one. But
so when we look at some of the treaties and some of the things that have been done by the federal government to direct the importation of goods into California.
Okay.
And or, you know, whether it be New York or what have you, one would think that that's kind of manipulating and creating a benefit to those particular ports.
Okay.
And I was kind of mentioning that this is kind of one that I think that they're, you know, it's not necessarily theoretical. I think we could easily prove it, but we just have to go into the cases whether the goods that are coming into these ports, whether the federal government has got its finger on the scale. Because let's just say this. If the federal government went into California, into Seal Beach or wherever that big port is that brings in all the stuff that almost became a Chinese port during the Clinton administration, if you remember that.
Right.
And they put their finger on the scale that said, you know, we've invested the money in this particular port to be able to bring the goods in from these different states and so forth for processing and so forth. And in other words, directing, saying, well, all goods in the Pacific Ocean coming into America need to come in through this one port. They don't have that power to do that. And I believe that they've done that because they've figured out ways to create favors and or give advantages to those who, you know, help them out. In other words, quid pro quo.
So it's possible that there could be some violations of this.
Yeah, so it says no preference shall be given.
Yeah, correct. By any regulation of commerce or revenue.
Right.
And so, which, and so this is a prohibition on the federal government.
Correct.
Okay.
Right. And I, my point is that it's not highlighted, but maybe it should be. Maybe it should be yellow. Maybe they have put their fingers on the scale and have actually provided, you know, I don't have time to go through all, you know, all of these different things, but my point is, you know, they're notorious for trying to create preferences. I mean, it is about pay and to play. I mean, how many administrations that we've looked at that have literally proven that they do payola? I mean, you've got to pay to play.
Right.
The Clintons were huge with this. They literally were going to give ports, you know, allow China to come in and have exclusive control over our ports. And they did it with the Panama Canal. And I mean, the fact that they even did that is unconscionable.
I thought what's his name? Carter did that.
No, it was Clinton. If you go back to the Chinese taking control of the Panama Canal, that was Clinton. And it's the same thing with the Long Beach or Seal Beach port and some other ports in America that China was coming in and using a contractor to bid for control and so forth. And the fact is, allowing a foreign company to come in and control our commerce and pay them and allow them to have that license, that's not in the Constitution. They shouldn't even be that involved. They shouldn't even be allowing and overseeing those types of things. The only thing they have the authority in Article 1, Section 8, just going up a couple of days, is to have the needful buildings to be able to account for what's coming in into these state ports. So I'm leaning more and more of at least making this one yellow.
Yeah. Okay.
And you know what? You've talked me into it. Okay, so let's move on to the next one. Go ahead.
All right. So the next one, no money shall be drawn from the treasury, but in consequence of appropriations made by law, and a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. So you've got this with the highest, most egregious highlight.
Yes.
When it says, but in consequence of appropriations made by law, okay, that would suggest that the supreme law of the land should be the standard for which appropriations are made. But then obviously,
So appropriations can only be made by those objects that are enumerated.
Correct.
Okay. So in other words, laws must be, so forgive me, laws must be in pursuance to the Constitution. So in other words, they can't create an appropriation and spend money on anything that is not enumerated. Goes back to health, you know, education, all these things. Go ahead.
Okay, correct. So that's one violation.
Hold it. I'm sorry. I just, once again, not watching the clock. And you know, you have the clock there too, Paul, so help me out here. Anyway, folks, we've got a break, and we'll dive back into this appropriations and how they've just been violating the Constitution when we do this little break. So Hang in there. We'll be right back after this. Thank you so much. The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our Constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google Donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contribution page, and you can become a listed supporter of liberty. Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416. Okay, so sorry about that, Paul. You were just about to say, and so you're probably on mute, Paul.
Or, I was.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I was just about to say, you know, we talked about appropriations made by law and then no money shall be drawn from the Treasury. Well, what has Congress done? It has delegated its Treasury functions to, without a constitutional amendment, to something called the Federal Reserve. And I don't know how do you even begin?
But let's start with the expenditure, and let's go back to the railroad, back in the 1820s. Okay. So Congress, you know, creates this law to create this favor towards these guys that are going to, you know, do this bulk movement of commerce. This seems like a really good idea. So they create a law that's not in pursuance to the Constitution. And then they go over and they say, okay, now we've got this law, and now we need this much money to buy this land so that these guys can lay down track and move these railroad cars and moving product around. Whatever it is and however they did what they did, and this money that they spent in support of the railroad endeavor in America, regardless of whether it was a noble thing, good thing, I don't care. It was not an enumerated thing, and bottom line, from the beginning to the end, the entire thing, everything that they did was all fraud.
Right.
Was a violation of this law or this part of the Constitution. No money shall be drawn from the Treasury, but in consequence of appropriations made by law. It is not law just because Congress agreed and signed a piece of paper. It is not law unless it is in pursuant to the Constitution. We got that very clear out of the ratification debates.
Yeah.
So, now, all of the rest of this, now the question is, because to be truthful, and a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. Now, in all honesty, that should all probably be black, because it's not that they don't do that. But right. The fact is what they have been doing. And so I'll make that black. And okay. The question is, let me ask you this. Should it even be read? Is there a point in time where Congress and the Treasury does not actually report its expenditures? Because I can go all the way back to the beginning, because I actually looked at the financial reports from the Treasury, because there was these wild assertions by, you know, these, I'll just call them the radical sovereigns out there, that said, oh, they've been giving money to Britain since the very beginning of the Constitution, you know, as a commonwealth, paying our dues to the crown. No, that's a blatant lie.
Well, they ought to be able to show us where that is.
Right, but they can't and they don't. So anyway, okay. I would basically say that when we look at, you know, this part, I'll just make that yellow because maybe they don't show everything.
Okay.
You know, like, you know, some of the classified stuff. And so I think they've been caught not actually accounting for money. Sometimes there are misaccounting or, you know, throwing the money around. It's not that they didn't spend it, but how they accounted for it. So okay. I'll make that part yellow.
Okay. I'll change that too.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
All right. Ready for the next one?
I am.
I like this one. No title of nobility shall be granted by the United States, and no person holding any office of profit or trust under them shall, without the consent of the Congress, except of any present, emolument, office, or title of any kind whatever from any king, prince, or foreign state.
Okay.
This.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
You probably ought to put, especially with this administration, you probably ought to give this the worst, okay? Because just because of the revelations that have come out about, you know, the family of the current occupant of the White House and their financial dealings. However, this title of nobility thing, you know, this got put in. It didn't have any teeth, but it still got put in there. Why did they do that? What were they thinking when they put this here in Section 9? I know we probably could go back to the ratification debates, but I'm just wondering if you could just pull that off. You know,
right. Yeah, so if you look, the British legal system, the bar, mm-hmm. really didn't take root until after, I think, the turn of the century. And
which
so
century?
The turn of, you know, the 1700s, you know, the turn of the 18th century into the 19th century, going into the 1800s. Okay. And so the Bar Association, as a matter of fact, if you look it up and you look up the bar, right? So what is the bar? The acronym bar is the British Accredited, something like that, registry. It's a weird British use of accreditation, but it is a registry that they have. And if you look at a listing of bar, you know, groups out there, there's a bar association everywhere where Britain has had their hands.
Okay.
In other words, Australia, I mean, even in Africa, these other places, there are bars, you know, in other words, these legal clubs that are controlling the law of the land.
So is there some place where there isn't a bar, where we have law that's, I mean, Britain's been everywhere.
I haven't done a thorough review, but I do know that America and the bar in America, it grants a person a title called Esquire when you've actually passed the bar and you become a full-fledged member. Right, you become an Esquire in the bar, and the Bar Association is a foreign entity.
That's
so
weird.
So they didn't realize this until after the turn of the century, which is why they created the 13th Amendment. So we'll get into that later.
Okay,
Go ahead.
Right.
What's that?
But they put it. You know. They, no title of nobility. Well, okay, so they put it here, but here's what I think on the one hand about it is that the founders didn't want to make people in separate classes. Okay? So let's say they didn't have the bar in mind, but in Britain they had the House of Lords and then they had the House of Commons, right? And it's like there were separate classes in England, correct?
Yes.
They didn't want to have that in America. They didn't want to have a class of people that was one above another. I really didn't. And, you know, notwithstanding that.
Okay, so hold on. What you're talking about is a caste system, right? Well, because a caste system is where you have one class of people above another class, right? And that's India. And that's really a predominant thing in the Indian culture. In Britain and in the European states, they didn't have a caste system. They had a bloodline system.
Okay. Oh.
And in America, they couldn't get rid of that bloodline.
What do you mean?
Well, what that means, I'll give you a good case in point. Yours truly, because my grandmother was really big on, because, you know, for whatever reason, when you find out that you have royalty in your in your bloodline, then it, you know, genealogy and those types of things really. You know, so my grandmother, I guess, you know, through the generations, you know, we're from the, you know, we're a part of, you know, Queen Mary, the Tudor period, and goes back to King John and so forth. So when you have that bloodline, then you what do you do? I mean, so at any point in time, there's lots of people that have the bloodline, and they can prove that they have the bloodline, but that doesn't mean that they have a title of nobility.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Sure. Well, then we should probably define what is a title of nobility that
Let's stop and let's finish this. Let's finish this. You have in England, because of the way things progressed in the monarchy circle, remember the land barons who were not direct descendants or related to King John, the land barons, as time progressed, those families actually started becoming and felt folded into the monarchical framework.
Okay.
In the form of dukes and barons and, or, you know, actually barons, I think it was German. But anyway, they became a noble family. And the reason this was done, I guess this is the epitome of how just maniacal the British were in manipulating people. By bringing them into the family fold, they would be less likely to revolt against the family.
Okay. In other words, sharing some of a portion of the wealth or the benefits, right?
Well, so they didn't get any portions because the land barons already controlled these areas of land.
So what did they get?
They got a title. They were given a title and they were given prestige by being this direct association to the monarchs. And so actually, what ended up happening was the land barons, as they broke things down, they broke everything down by counts. So the ultimate lowest class, I think, in the British royalty of the extended family were the counts that controlled the counties. Or the land that the counts controlled were later called counties. And so if you look in American history, the reason why we have counties is from that lowest line of noble class of people that controlled or governed the people of this area and land called a county.
Okay.
So when we look at how widespread the families were, a person could have easily been in line with becoming a duke or a duchess or a count.
Okay.
And so here in America, because we had families that left those families, and it was, I think, in everybody's face to understand, we cannot allow that system of that upper class bloodline to permeate in America, which is why they created this.
Okay. That and that's So that's what they were thinking at the time, all right?
Right.
And no person holding any office or trust under them shall, without the consent of Congress, accept of any present emolument, office to, or title of any kind, whatever, from any king, prince, or foreign state. Emolument. Let's define that. Because they use present, and then they use emolument.
Well, right. So what is an emolument? I'll let you Google emolument definition, but when you look at emolument, the emoluments that were offered by this Constitution to those who were in the service of the people was a salary while in service. In other words, an emolument is, if correct me if I'm wrong, as you're looking it up, an emolument is a benefit. It's a financial gain or a benefit, you know, like a healthcare. Or here's an emolument, having free security for the rest of your life, you know, having your own detachment of Secret Service men serving you to protect you. That would be an emolument. Is that not correct based on the definition that you just looked up? And what is the definition of emolument?
It says a salary fee or profit from employment for office. Let's see, or profit, salary, or fees from office employment, compensation for services, tips, or an emolument in addition to wages.
Right. So it's anything that can be formed into a monetary value. Is the Secret Service being provided to the former presidents, is that an emolument?
Well, sure.
It is, but in the Constitution, did a former president have any emoluments?
Not that I don't see that.
Which is why I rail and rail to people that any former president, senator, and congressman, because they were not to have, the Constitution did not allow them to become a leech off the people for their entire life. They only were to be compensated while they were in office. And shoot, hey, we're making careers out of this, and all these other people in the private sector have these benefits, so we want them too. Okay, well, that's fine. You should have, one, amended the Constitution to do that. And two, as a part of that amendment process, you'd have to also amend the impeachment process to ensure that those emoluments can be removed after an impeachment of a former president and or former senator, blah, blah, blah. Now, the impeachment process regarding, you know, the senators, judges, representatives, everybody but the president literally shifted and was redefined by Section 3 of the 14th Amendment.
Correct.
In other words, you don't have a right to be in, you know, you don't have a right to the impeachment process anymore. You violate your oath. Now, doesn't mean that it didn't completely wipe out impeachment. In other words, if somebody committed adultery and that was a criminal law and that was unacceptable behavior, that person could be impeached. But in other words, you couldn't use Section 3 of the 14th Amendment to remove that person. It's not that they, you know, violated their oath by, you know, insurrecting against the Constitution. They may have insurrected against the institution of marriage and their wife or their spouse, but that's not the same thing. So, in other words, Section 3 didn't completely wipe out impeachment. But it did wipe it out when it came down to the execution of a person's job and fulfilling their oath. Okay. So anyway, did I just go down a bunch of rat holes and not connect the dots? I mean, I don't want to confuse you.
I'm not confused. It's just that we're not. The point is that we're not supposed to receive any gift from any foreign state, king or prince. That's an emolument, title, anything of the kind. And
right,
I think
correct.
We clarified that.
Correct.
Because they may not, as you say, they may not have thought of attorneys at the time, considering that the direction you said didn't become stronger until after the turn of, you know, 18th, 19th century. But once we got, and I'm sure we'll get to you know, the 14th Amendment. Once we got further along, the original 13th Amendment, that's not here in the color-coded Constitution, is it?
No, it's, well, actually, it is. It is. We'll get to it. Don't worry. It's there. I included everything. I even think I included the Jefferson's 1803 Amendment. But what's really important, before we move off of this, is this was just brought up regarding the death of Dianne Feinstein.
Okay.
And I was waiting for this part to talk about this.
Okay.
Newsom was going to, believe it or not, I think somebody mentioned that Gavin Newsom was going to consider nominating and basically sending Markle in to replace her. He wanted a black woman, right? I mean, he threw out, you know, the high road and said, I don't care what it is, it's going to be a person that has a very specific agenda instead of the Constitution, because we want somebody to go in there to attack the Constitution. So the person, I think I heard the name, I'm bad at this.
But that was announced yesterday.
Monday.
California Governor Newsom names replacement for Feinstein. And the person is...
Yeah. So while he was considering it, one of the names on the table was Princess Markle. You know, what's her first name? She's actually her last... That's not her last name anymore, but...
Meghan Markle.
Meghan, right.
He did not appoint her.
He did not, but what would have happened had he appointed her?
I see what you're saying.
It would have been another slap in the face of another part of the Constitution that we have just completely lost sight of.
Right.
The fact that she was even on the short list. I had heard that she was on the short list. And I'm going, you got to be kidding me. I mean, nobody even looks at this document anymore.
Right.
I mean, it's bad enough that the Republicans are allowing Vivek Ramaswamy and Nikki Haley to even campaign as a president. That should not be happening.
I had breakfast with Tom Marks on Friday, and you may have talked to Tom. He is probably the subject matter expert on the Missouri Constitution. He asked me a question. He said, there are two people that aren't even qualified to run for office. He said, do you know who they are? And I said, sure. Nikki Haley and Vivek Ramaswamy. He said, you are the only person who's been able to answer that question for me. Okay. They have, at the very least, their parents should have been naturalized citizens when they were born, at least.
Obama, right? Obama, based on the definition of a naturally born citizen of the 26 March 1790, when Congress laid out what that definition was, Obama could not have been president based on that definition. They had to redefine it over the years and wipe out what the original definition was. But if you look at the original definition, he could not have been president.
He could not have been. And interestingly, we don't have to take this too far, but interestingly, he spent millions hiding, not releasing information about himself. I guess I don't want to charge down that rat hole because we've got so much.
But you mentioned Tom Marks. Yeah, I know you've mentioned in part of that comment that I had talked to him. I've not talked to Tom yet.
Oh, okay. All right.
So anyway, all right. Really? So now that we've kind of gone the full process and we've covered Meghan Markle, thank you for helping with the name. Now we're ready for Article 1, Section 10.
Now, apparently, Article 1, Section 9 was prohibitions on the federal government.
Yes.
Article 1, Section 10 is prohibitions on the states, correct?
Correct. Absolutely.
Okay. All right.
And so, there are some similarities. In other words, if you look at some of the restrictions on the federal government, those, some of those same restrictions were placed on the states, and we'll cover those. But let's just go ahead, and we can start off with this. If you want to talk, you know, a little bit, a line, a little bit, a line, a little bit, a line, because there's a few things packed in this one paragraph or this one section, subsection, I should say.
There sure are. I think what I'll do is read the whole thing.
Okay.
And then maybe back to, so no state shall enter into any treaty, alliance, or confederation, grant letters of marque and reprisal, coin money, emit bills of credit, make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debts, pass any bill of attainder, ex post facto law, or law impairing the obligation of contracts, or any title of nobility. You know, we're going to be covering Section 10 and the next show, I'm sure. But because there's a lot of meat in here.
Just in that one line, correct. And so there's actually a little bit of expounding on the very first part of this. No state shall enter into any treaty, alliance, or confederation. And then if you look at the very bottom, the last line says, enter into any agreement or compact within another state or with a foreign power or engage in war unless actually invaded. So in other words, if a state's invaded, they can actually start engaging in a war.
Right.
Or in such imminent danger as will not admit of delay. And so this invasion could actually, in an election, when we realize that there are people that have come into your state from other states that have actually gotten, you know, voter qualification, now coming in to get voter qualified, you know, they could, using deadly force, but I mean, they could actually start repelling and, you know, executing the laws of the union. But
what you're pointing out here, and I guess we've only got about a minute and a half, but I want to touch this again, is that the Constitution actually gives a state the authority to engage in war if it's invaded and such imminent danger as will not admit of delay.
For the federal. So the reason is that the federal government, remember, the army doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. It is not to have a standing army at all, not for enforcement or for protection. It is to federalize the militia first. So in other words, a state can get engaged first, and then while they're doing that, the federal government must federalize the militia, bringing in the militia of other states to deploy to where that militia is needed to be deployed to deal with the invasion or what have you.
Yep.
Okay. So, I mean, they actually did this so that it actually would work and make sense. I mean, these guys really looked and they found these little problems that go, hey, hold on here. We can't be totally dependent on the federal government to defend ourselves. No.
Right
here, they clearly have. And when you look at Article 4, they also have that latitude. Thank you so much for joining us today, Paul. And folks, as we move forward in reading the Constitution, we're plugging away. We're going to be probably diving into Article 2 tomorrow. But we got to wrap up with Article 1, Section 10 tomorrow first before we do that. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcast and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Mobius Strip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Mobius Strip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you.